the proliferating technologies which create governments dealing with certain ethical issues. And it seems that the UN does not have, say, like a future studies division, but it's something that I think is very needed, because if you look at the computer records, in other words, the government right now is actually denying access to people such as reporters under the Freedom of Information Act, based on their deciding that computer records are not because they're not paper files. In other words, they're not considered records by the U.S. government.
Right,
so I think that's an important issue.
They're not considered in the same way as regular data.
Exactly. And this is very, very scary. I also happen to be an African-American, and when I see the type of fascism just on the police level, and, you know, in terms of what we experience here, our history in this country, it's something that, you know, the people who, if you would say that they're up in their ivory towers or everything seems to be okay and I have nothing to hide, I have nothing to fear, but, you know, we're really going toward a brave new world, if you will. And just signing off here, I would like Steve, if he would just kind of hone in on some of the really activist things that we can do in terms of your plight, and where are you going from here? And I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Thanks for your call.
Okay.
Steve?
I don't know. I'm new enough to this that I don't really know where the pressure points are that can get a response out of a federal agency that is accustomed to working in secret and having its own way. I think that probably writing your senators and congressmen and just suggesting that they make themselves aware of the kind of things that are going on is probably the best thing to do. Just let them, I mean, all through our history, it's been a fight between, you know, people who are really, really guarding the freedoms and people who will take them away. And a tactic that you see happening over and over again is making a great imaginary menace and then taking away people's rights in order to deal with the imaginary menace, just like the Americans of Japanese ancestry were rounded up and caged during the Second World War. They were supposed to be a terrible menace, and certain elements got enough people in the government very excited about that there was a terrible human rights injustice. This isn't on such a gross scale, but it threatens anybody who uses a computer.
Well, you know, it doesn't have to be on a gross scale. Any situation is arrived at by a series of steps. Whether it's a small step, whether it's a large step, it's a step all the same. And a step I don't think that we want to take. For those of you interested in pursuing this further, you may want to get a pen and paper handy, because we'll tell you all the facts as far as what is going on. To sum up, Steve Jackson Games was raided on March 1st, was it? Steve, are you there? Okay, Steve, I guess is off. Oh, he's off the line. Uh-oh, well, we seem to have lost Steve. We'll get him back in a moment. Steve Jackson Games was raided on March 1st, 1990, in Austin, Texas, by the Secret Service. Now, that's something right there. A factual bit of information. Nobody is disputing that. And if you want to write a letter to your congressman, that is one of the facts that you should include. However, that's only one aspect to all of this. The media is the other big player here. And if you alert the media, as Steve said before, the Secret Service was very upset by the publicity that this story was receiving. And keep in mind, the publicity hasn't exactly been the kind of publicity you're hearing tonight on WBAI. The publicity has been pretty much sensationalism. And I'm using a nice word there compared to the words I could use. That kind of story and this kind of story are something that the Secret Service certainly does not want to see, and one has to wonder why. So writing letters to the newspapers, calling the newspapers, calling the TV stations and the radio stations and saying, why aren't you covering this story and giving them the facts? That's something that will have an effect, because all it takes is one story. One story on the news at 6, one story in the newspapers, and then you'll start seeing results. Look at yourself. You're listening to this now. You're hearing about this perhaps for the first time, and you didn't know about this yesterday. And you're hearing about it because one radio station is doing something. Okay, so there's a bunch of things you, as individual people, can do. You can contact your media people. You can contact your elected representatives. And certainly not least important, you can help support WBAI. Because doing that will ensure that we don't miss a story like this in the future, that we are here to keep our eyes open and to spread the word about situations like this. So give a call to 279-3400 and also get a copy, get a full year subscription to 2600 Magazine when you make that call. 2600 Magazine has donated an unlimited amount of subscriptions to this radio station, because that's a donation to the cause of freedom of speech, to the cause of education with high technology and all the assorted issues that go with it. It's not just a technical journal, though there are sections of it that are very technical, but it's also a social journal. It's also the only way you're going to find out about the abuses of high tech by the authorities. And those abuses are going on left and right. We're going to get into the rest of this whole story in just a little bit, but we want to see those phones ring. Okay, we're going to take a short musical break. We're going to come back. During that short musical break, I intend to journey down to Tally and find out how we've been doing. And it would sure make me happy to see the Tally people busy. I mean, we need a strong response. We need to keep this station going, because we're radio producers. We're people that go out there and find stories like this and bring it to you. We're not professional salesmen. That's why we sound clumsy when we ask for money. It doesn't bother me that I sound clumsy asking for money. That's just the way it is. I'd rather be able to pursue a story and recognize a story when I see it than be a good salesman. But by giving a call to 279-3400, supporting this radio station, you're giving us a vote of confidence, and you're telling the world that free speech, free ideas, they mean something. They still mean something. Let me read this one more time. I've been carrying this with me all day long, and I've been showing it to people left and right. And you know, a lot of people don't even know what this is. They didn't know it was so compact. The First Amendment, folks, here it is. The First Amendment on this little piece of paper. Complete and unabridged. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. You should memorize that. You should memorize that and quote it when necessary. In fact, I'd like to see a song have that as the lyrics. Maybe a hardcore band would write that or something. But it's so important that we know this, that we remain educated. And if you get 2600 delivered to you, you'll remain educated, believe me. So give a call to 279-3400, make that pledge, support WBAI, and help yourself out. We're going to try to get through to Steve again, and we're going to get to the rest of this story right after this. Don't give me that brother. Damn it, that's a good song. John Lennon from his first album, Plastic Ono Band, 1970. Ooh, 20 years ago, I found out. And it's a quarter after one. You're listening to WBAI in New York. We found Steve Jackson again. Steve, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, we're all at the mercy of technology here.
Yeah, for some inexplicable reason, we got disconnected. We don't know why. Maybe something's going on out there. I don't know. The response has been fairly good. I think it can be a little bit better, though. I really do. 279-3400. Show your support for WBAI. We do need volunteers. We need people to help us answer the phone. It's a lot of fun to answer the phone, too, by the way. I never forget the first time I did that. 212-279-3400 if you want to donate something to WBAI or if you want to volunteer your time as well. That would be just great. Remember, for $55, you'll get a subscription to 2600 Magazine, and you can find out the latest, the things that you won't see in Newsday, you won't see in the Post, you won't see in the Times, you won't see anyplace else. You gotta wonder why. 212-279-3400. That's the number to call. Steve, why don't you give out your phone number again? And also, I was thinking it would be nice if people could be assured of getting a copy of the latest game that you put out, the game that was seized by the Secret Service. Is there a place they can write to get that?
Encourage people to give their business to the local retailer because the community business needs all the help it can get. But yes, someone who can't find it locally can write to us. We will sell them by mail. Our phone number is 512-447-7866. If anyone out there has a modem and wants to call our bulletin board, we'd welcome that. And that's 512-447-4449. And we could take a mail order for the game at Box 18957, Austin, Texas, 78760. And I'm not quite sure what the price is supposed to be. I think it's a little bit over $18.50, so let me just say that anybody who sends us $18.50, that's the postage and handling price. Anybody who sends us $18.50, you know, tell them Steve said that was all right.
And what's the name of the game again?
GURPS, G-U-R-P-S, Cyberpunk.
Okay. And people that want to communicate with Steve Jackson about this information are encouraged to call, to write, and to keep abreast of the situation. Remember, keep in touch with your local media, keep in touch with your local elected representatives, because they're the ones that really have a lot of control over this kind of situation, a lot of power. And I think that's something that we're going to have to demonstrate in the weeks ahead. Steve, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us, and wish you all the luck in the world.
Thank you. Thank you for calling, and I enjoyed the show. I learned from it. I just wish I could hear the rest. So you all out there who can hear the rest, have fun with it.
Okay, well, we're on for another 2 hours and 10 minutes. So, again, thanks very much for participating, and we'll be keeping people updated as to what goes on in the future.
Thank you, Emmanuel.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
We've been talking with Steve Jackson of Steve Jackson Games in Austin, Texas. He runs a publishing company. His publishing company was raided by the Secret Service on March 1st, and a game, a role-playing game, and its manuscript was seized and taken away as evidence in some still as yet undetermined computer hacker case. It's very strange, it's very odd, and we don't really know where it's heading, but we do know there's a lot more to tell you about. We've got John Perry Barlow, a writer from Wyoming, who's going to be our next guest as we explore the emergency 911 system, the connections with the Legion of Doom, and the shutting down of a newsletter. All coming up here on WBAI. Remember, 279-3400, we have to see those phones light up. We've got to see the support coming in, because only through your support can we continue doing this. Folks, if we put commercials on, do you think they'd let us do programs like this? Think how many corporate sponsors would find it rather uncomfortable dealing with a program that talks about hackers and individuality above all else, that kind of thing. Now, it sounds nice when you talk about it, and the concepts of individuality is something we should all be fighting for, but put into practice, it's not profitable. It's not something that you want to devote a lot of time to, because it's controversial with a lot of people. You know, criticizing the Secret Service on the radio, that comes down to criticizing the government on the radio, and, you know, a sponsor would not want to be associated with that. So we'd have to tone down our programming to please the sponsors. It's a catch-22. If we don't have sponsors, we don't have a source of income. That's why we need our listeners to be that source of income. Think of it, for only $55 for the entire year, you can be assured that you're doing your bit to keep WBAI going. You'll become a part. You'll be investing in this radio station. You'll become a part of WBAI. And as incentive, we're sending you a year of 2600 Magazine, the Hacker Quarterly. It'll be your way of keeping in touch, finding out what's going on in the world of high tech. And boy, what a fascinating world it is. A fascinating world and a very scary world if you don't know what's happening. If you don't know how you can be monitored and how your freedoms can be curtailed. Not just by having the Secret Service beat down your door every time you pick up the phone. Every time you make a banking transaction or use your Visa card. Every time you do just about anything today. Wouldn't it be nice to understand all of that? 279-3400. Make your pledge and make a stand at the same time. Area code 212. We're going to get on to the next part of our program. First, a public service announcement. Talk about corporate pressure. You know, the Clash were forced to take out that middle part of the song with a commercial about the toilet flushing, because the company that does that actual toilet flushing got all upset and said they didn't want to be associated with that anti-government song. which the Clash put out back in 1982. And so they were forced on all the ensuing records to eliminate that part of the song, which I think is the best part of the song. But fortunately, some of us bought a whole lot of the earlier versions and saved them for just such a special occasion. But it shows you the power that entities can have when they don't want some form of expression to be voiced. And certainly, there are many, many entities that don't want our form of expression to be expressed. And we know, we can see by the response we're getting tonight, that there are a lot of you out there that do care. So please, if you have not called yet, make that call now. Because when we see numbers pile in, when we see lots of people calling, it gives us inspiration. It makes us want to go further. Because we know you're out there. We know you care enough to support the station. 279-3400, area code 212. And keep thoughts like this coming. We don't want to spend a whole lot of time pitching and begging for money. We have to, unfortunately. That's just the rules of the game here. But we don't want to spend a whole lot of time on it. So if we see some calls come in, if we see some more calls come in while this next bit is going on, then we won't have to spend a whole lot of time on it. Again, 212-279-3400 for a pledge of $55. You'll get a full year of 2600 Magazine. And you'll find out all about computer hackers and what they're up to and what the government is up to and all kinds of other fascinating tidbits. All right, continuing with the story, we've been speaking with Steve Jackson of Steve Jackson Games in Austin, Texas, whose company was raided by the Secret Service, but that was only one part of this whole big story. Let's go back to the 2600 story from the spring issue of 1990 and learn about another magazine, another electronic newsletter. And in case you missed the explanation before, an electronic newsletter is one that you get over a computer. You get it through the telephone lines and it comes up on your computer screen, or you get it as a diskette that you put into your computer and read the data that way. Same thing though, it's information being passed around in a different way, not on paper but on disk. Of course, you can print it out on paper and then it becomes on paper, but that's not the way it originally comes out. Anyway, in St. Louis, Missouri, there was such an electronic newsletter. It was known as FRACK, P-H-R-A-C-K, mixture of the word freak, spelled with a P-H for phone freaks, and hack, computer hackers. There's a newsletter about phone freaks and computer hackers and what kind of things went on, the strange and mystical world of computer hackers. And this electronic newsletter would come out every month or so, with all kinds of assorted files. And it was distributed worldwide. It could be found on just about all hacker bulletin boards. And while dealing with sensitive material, the editors of this magazine were very careful not to publish anything illegal, such as credit card numbers, passwords, Sprint codes, MCI codes, AT&T calling cards, that kind of thing, you know? Because that's not legal, and hackers know that. And believe it or not, most hackers don't want to do things that are illegal. Well, 2600 described FRACK World News, which was a regular column of the FRACK newsletter, as a must-read for many hackers. And in many ways, FRACK resembled 2600, with the exception of being sent via electronic mail instead of U.S. mail. And that distinction would prove to be FRACK's undoing. It now turns out that all incoming and outgoing electronic mail used by FRACK was being monitored by the authorities. Every piece of mail going in and every piece of mail coming out. These were not pirated mailboxes that were being used by a couple of hackers. These had been obtained legally through the school the two FRACK editors were attending. And privacy on such mailboxes, though not guaranteed, could always be assumed. But never again. It's fairly obvious that none of this would have happened, none of this could have happened, had FRACK been a non-electronic magazine. a printed magazine would not be intimidated into giving up its mailing list as Frack was. Had a printed magazine been shut down in this fashion after having all of their mail opened and read, even the most thick-headed sensationalist media types would have caught on. They would have said, isn't that a violation of the First Amendment? Reading their mail, opening their mail, seizing their mailing list, shutting them down. Well, those media people who understood what was happening and saw the implications were very quickly drowned out in the hysteria that followed, because indictments were being handed out. And one of the publishers and editors of Frack, whose name is Craig Nidorf, is known in the hacker world as Night Lightning, he was hit with a 7-count indictment accusing him of participating in a scheme to steal information about the enhanced 911 system run by Bell South. And very quickly, headlines screamed that hackers had broken into the 911 system and were interfering with emergency telephone calls to the police. One newspaper report said there were no indications that anyone had died or been injured as a result of the intrusions. Quite a relief, isn't it? Unfortunately, it's not quite true. In actuality, there have been very grievous injuries suffered as a result of these intrusions, but the intrusions we're referring to are those of the government and the media. The injuries have been suffered by the defendants, who will have great difficulty resuming normal lives, even if all of this is forgotten tomorrow. And if it's not forgotten, Craig Nidorf could go to jail for more than 30 years and be fined $122,000. And for what? Well, we have a copy of the indictment. Let's go through a little bit of it. It was part of the scheme that Defendant Nidorf, utilizing a computer at the University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri, would and did receive a copy of the stolen E911 text file from Defendant Robert J. Riggs, who was located in Atlanta and known in the hacker world as Prophet, through the Lockport, Illinois computer bulletin board system through the use of an interstate computer data network. It was further part of the scheme that Defendant Nidorf would and did edit and retype the E911 practice text file at the request of the defendant Riggs in order to conceal the source of the E911 practice text file and to prepare it for publication in a computer hacker newsletter. It was further part of the scheme that Defendant Nidorf would and did transfer the stolen E911 practice text file through the use of an interstate computer bulletin board system used by Defendant Riggs in Lockport, Illinois. And it was further part of the scheme that the defendants, Riggs and Nidorf, would publish information to other computer hackers which could be used to gain unauthorized access to emergency 911 computer systems in the United States and thereby disrupt or halt 911 service in portions of the United States. Okay, that's a look at the indictment. Basically, Nidorf is being charged with receiving a stolen document. Now, there's nothing anywhere in the indictment that even suggests he entered any computer illegally, or at all, for that matter. So his crimes are receiving, editing, and transmitting. Now, what is contained in this document? Information about how to gain unauthorized access to, disrupt, or halt 911 service? Hardly. The document, which was erroneously referred to as 911 software by the media, which caused all kinds of misunderstandings, that document is quoted in Frack Volume 2, Number 24, and makes for one of the dullest articles ever to appear in the newsletter. And according to the indictment, the value of this 6-page document is $79,449. Now, you may recall that the Legion of Doom has been implicated in all of this. Well, shortly after all these indictments were handed down, a member of the Legion of Doom, known as Eric Bloodaxe, issued a public statement, and it read as follows. A group of three hackers ended up pulling files off a Southern Bell system for them to look at. This is usually standard procedure. You get on a system, look around for interesting text, buffer it, which means save it to your computer, and maybe print it out for posterity. No member of LOD, Legion of Doom, has ever, to my knowledge, broken into another system and used any information gained from it for personal gain of any kind, with the exception of maybe a big boost in his reputation around the underground. A hacker took the documentation to the system and wrote a file about it. There are actually two files. One is an overview, the other is a glossary. The information is hardly something anyone could possibly gain anything from except knowledge about how a certain aspect of the telephone company works. He went on to say that Nidoff would have had no way of knowing whether or not the file contained proprietary information. Now, prosecutors refused to say how hackers could benefit from the information, nor would they cite a motive or reveal any actual damage. In addition, it's widely speculated that much of this information is readily available as reference material. Now, in all the indictments, the Legion of Doom is defined as a closely knit group of computer hackers involved in A, disrupting telecommunications by entering computerized telephone switches and changing the routing on the circuits of the computerized switches, B, stealing proprietary computer source code and information from companies and individuals that own the code and information, C, stealing and modifying credit information on individuals maintained in credit bureau computers, D, fraudulently obtaining money and property from companies by altering the computerized information used by the companies, E, disseminating information with respect to their methods of attacking computers to other computer hackers in an effort to avoid the focus of law enforcement agencies and telecommunication security experts. Ironically, since the Legion of Doom isn't a closely knit group, and anybody who's involved in computer hacking can tell you that, since they're not a closely knit group, it's very unlikely that anyone will be able to defend the group's name against these charges, because any defendants will naturally be preoccupied with their own defenses. And just to clear up another point here, Craig Nidoff of Frack Newsletter is not a part of the Legion of Doom, nor was Frack a publication of LOD, as has been reported in the media left and right. So we see here, we see quite a few things. We see that the 911 software that these computer hackers had access to was actually a six-page document explaining some of the administrative functions of running a 911 system. Nothing outrageous, nothing that would allow you to gain control of the system. However, if your only source of information were the major newspapers and the TV networks, you would be getting quite a different picture. Quite a different picture indeed. And the upshot of this is that a newsletter dealing with these issues has been shut down. Shut down by the authorities because what they were doing was dangerous. Discussing these things was a threat. Curiouser and curiouser. We have on the phone line with us now John Perry Barlow from the heart of Wyoming. John, you're a writer, but you're also a lot of other things. Maybe you could spend a couple of seconds telling us some of the other things you're up to.
Well, I'm an adult white male.
Okay,
that's a good thing to be in America. I write for the Grateful Dead. I'm writing a book for Viking about computers and consciousness. I was a cattle rancher for 17 years on a real ranch. Before I got involved in all this stuff, and I'm at the moment I find myself increasingly an advocate for computer crackers and something like a legal scoutmaster for a small group of them. I'm very concerned about what's going on from the standpoint of civil liberties. I mean, I'm still a registered Republican, but I tend to be a conservative of the old school, which is that the best government is the least government.
Well, let me ask you, how did you get involved in the high tech world and in the concept of hacking?
Just lucky, I guess. It's actually a longer story than you want to hear, I think. But what happened originally was a couple of years ago, I was asked by my collaborator in the Grateful Dead to go down with him to Apple Computer and help him give a lecture on songwriting with the Macintosh. And at that time, I didn't use a Macintosh, and neither did he, so the whole thing was kind of a fraud. But Apple at that time had given a lot of equipment to the Grateful Dead, and so we kind of had to get one for the core, and we went down there. And I was going to get up and say that it was very nice and get back down again, but when I looked out at this sea of deadheads, I realized I couldn't lie to them, so I told them that I didn't use a Macintosh. I thought they were user promiscuous and glacially slow. And they all hooted and jeered, and I sat back down. I thought that was the end of it. But then some months later, I got a letter from somebody at Apple saying that they wanted to give me a computer. And I thought that was fine. I could like let my kids use it or something. And then they didn't give me a computer, and time went on, and I started writing them a series of increasingly peevish letters about how it was perfectly okay not to give me a computer, but it wasn't okay to tell me they were going to and then not do it. Finally, I got a phone call from somebody at Apple saying, well, your computer is in the mail, and furthermore, we'd like you to collaborate on a history of Apple Computer, which kind of came out of the blue. But they'd been enjoying my letters, I guess. So when I got out of the cattle business and started casting around for things to do next, just about the wildest proposition I'd heard was writing the history of Apple Computer. So I went out and took a look at that. And that project has metamorphosed into an interest in this area. I mean, when I got out there, I realized that Apple was for all of its tie-dye trappings, was really just another corporation, and I wasn't sure that I wanted to write any corporation's personal account of itself. But I became interested in the culture that goes along with this. I mean, this whole field. I mean, the personal involvement with information technology that computers have extended to people is really the most interesting thing that's going on in this culture at the moment, as far as I'm concerned. Especially if you care about freedom and the ability of people to think for themselves and determine their own lives.
So how do you see all this as relating to what we've been discussing with the raids by the Secret Service in recent months?
Well, it's perfectly predictable, really. I mean, you know, there's really only one contest that's gone on throughout history, and that's the contest between the people who fear uncertainty and want to control human behavior and everything else that they can possibly control, and those people who find opportunity in uncertainty and want every opportunity for themselves. You know, it's the control freaks versus the libertarians, and it was true in Athens, and it's true today. So anytime you've got people who are poking around in the core of what has come to be the central resource of a society, in this case that's information, you're going to get other people who want to control their behavior. I'm not surprised by this at all. I guess the only thing that surprises me is that they're so lame.
How so?
Well, first of all, what they're doing is directly and blatantly unconstitutional, and in the fullness of time, they're going to get nailed for it. Also, my experience with these investigators in a related matter, I was visited by the FBI not too long ago, indicates to me that they really don't know anything that they're talking about. I mean, the FBI man that came to visit me was... he had a wealth of misinformation, some of it just purely fantastic. And this was after an 11-month investigation.
I should point out, this is something else. This is another thing that
That's right.
That is going on, having to do with...
another hacker investigation.
Another kind of hacker investigation, and there must be a lot of hacker investigations. This Operation Sun Devil, which just came down last week, supposedly had 150 Secret Service agents working on it. What do you think something like that costs?
156, did you say?
150. That's according to their press release. 150 Secret Service agents were involved in this. I didn't even know there were 150 Secret Service agents. When I grew up, the Secret Service was just to protect the president.
Well, by my count, that gives you something like five Secret Service agents for every real master cracker in the country.
Well, I guess that's enough to make them feel secure.
Yeah.
Well, let me read something
here.
Those
are good odds. It's no wonder that they're getting so many people, is it?
It's true. Let me just read something here as far as the most recent in the hacker raids, the Operation Sun Devil, which happened last week. And we'll just add this on to the 911 raids of a couple of months ago, and then we'll try to figure the whole mess out and what's really going on. And also, of course, the FRAC newsletter shutdown. This is what Assistant Director of the Secret Service Gary M. Jenkins said on, I believe it was May 9th of this year, and this was in Phoenix, Arizona. Today, the Secret Service is sending a clear message to those computer hackers who have decided to violate the laws of this nation in the mistaken belief that they can successfully avoid detection by hiding behind the relative anonymity of their computer terminals. In 1984, Congress enacted the Comprehensive Crime Control Act. This is the real 1984, not the book, which prohibits, among other things, credit card fraud and computer fraud. Since 1984, the Secret Service has been aggressively enforcing these laws and has made over 9,000 arrests nationwide. Okay, all fine and dandy. But recently, we have witnessed an alarming number of young people who, for a variety of sociological and psychological reasons, have become attached to their computers and are exploiting their potential in a criminal manner. Often, a progression of criminal activity occurs which involves telecommunications fraud, that is, free long-distance phone calls, unauthorized access to other computers, whether for profit, fascination, ego, or the intellectual challenge, credit card fraud, cash advances, and unauthorized purchases of goods. And then these people move on to other destructive activities like computer viruses. Some computer abusers form close associations with other people having similar interests. Underground groups have been formed for the purpose of exchanging information relevant to their criminal activities. These groups often communicate with each other through message systems between computers called bulletin boards. Operation Sun Devil was an investigation of potential computer fraud conducted over a 2-year period with the use of sophisticated investigative techniques. This investigation exemplifies the commitment and extensive cooperation between federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies and private and governmental industries which have been targeted by computer criminals. While state and local law enforcement agencies successfully investigate and prosecute technological crimes in specific geographical locations, federal intervention is clearly called for when the nature
I'm sorry that I'm helping pay for it.
We all are. Something that struck me there, they differentiated here between two kinds of people. They say computer hacker suspects are no longer misguided teenagers mischievously playing games with their computers in their bedrooms. Some are now high-tech computer operators using computers to engage in unlawful conduct. Are they saying then that if they're not high-tech computer operators using computers to engage in unlawful conduct, if they're not up to something really nefarious, then they're harmless people playing in their bedrooms? Because that's the point we've been trying to make all this time. It sounds almost like they've made that point for us. Of course, people that commit crimes, that steal things, they're criminals, and there's no computer hacker around that I know of that argues that point. But somebody that is simply exploring and looking into other systems,
as far as I'm concerned. Look at the semantics of that statement.
Uh-huh.
Somehow it's more unlawful to be a mature, sophisticated, technically expert adult than it is to be a playful teenager.
What?
I mean, the point of the statement has nothing to do with the actual thrust of the activities. It has to do with the style of the person that's conducting them.
Uh-huh.
In other words, it's okay to bust sophisticated users of computers. It's not okay to bust playful kids in bedrooms. So, in other words, Mr. and Mrs. America, you don't need to worry about your son or daughter unless he's, you know, out of the house and, you know, technically sophisticated.
So, in other words, the Secret Service doesn't go around raiding the homes of kids who are innocently playing games on their computers. They raid the homes of kids that are master criminals.
Apparently, though, mm-hmm. you know, in my experience with this sweep, they've been raiding the homes of kids that are playing with their computers in their bedrooms. I mean, most of the folks that I've talked to in the Legion of Doom are young, exploratory, basically harmless folks. I mean, there doesn't seem to be much crime in them.
Well, if they're...
Irony to me, you know, at this point, the principal irony of all this is that these people are being accused of stealing and disrupting information, when in fact the only information that's been stolen is the information that's been unlawfully confiscated from the members of the Legion of Doom by the Secret Service without due process, without formal charges. Megabytes and megabytes of data were stolen by the Secret Service as far back as the 1st of March and not returned, and there's been no opportunity for these people to retrieve their property.
Now, we've also seen a computer newsletter get taken out of existence by these raids. We've seen the complete distortion of the whole 911 case.
It is, by the way, the most boring document I've ever read, and I've spent time dealing with the United States Forest Service, which is pretty good at it.
So you wouldn't pay $80,000 for that 6-page document, would you?
No. Well, I might pay $79,448 or whatever it is. I mean, it's not quite worth $80,000, but
that's
I wouldn't. But I mean, that's another thing that's kind of at the heart of the matter. How do you put a value on a 6-page text file that can be reproduced infinitely many times? I mean, what is the actual value of this? And to put a value down to the penny on it really underscores the confusion of authority in the face of an entirely new ballgame. You know, this isn't a car or a stereo or a horse, but they're trying to put some kind of monetary value on it as though it were.
And it's also, if you obtain a copy of it, you're obtaining just that. You're not obtaining an actual, you're not stealing it from somebody. You're
exactly.
Simply looking at it.
I mean, I've got a copy in my hands right now.
Well, I don't know if you should say that on in front of millions of people here, because...
Well, they can come and get it from me if they want, but I've got a copy of it.
Well, it's...
I'm sure the phone company would be very upset.
In
any way, limiting the ability of Southern Bell to use this document by my having it.
Now, I don't think it was coincidence that when this story first broke, all the newspapers said that these kids were interfering with the 911 system. They had the software, and they were able to manipulate it, when in actuality, all they had was a 6-page text file explaining some of the more mundane processes at work. I don't think that was a coincidence. I think that was a pretty well-designed way to make it seem as if they were up to something a lot worse than what actually was.
And they're in a good position. I mean, the control freaks always like to use scare tactics in order to increase their control. And if you don't know anything about computers, and you do know that you want the 911 system to work, I can't think of anything better than to be telling people through the media that there are these completely nihilistic, lawless people who have stolen the software that controls your lifeline under certain emergency circumstances. You know, what this document actually talks about is billing, accountability, marketing, what the phone company is supposed to provide the customer in terms of services. I mean, this is dense bureaucracies which provides absolutely no information that anybody could use to do anything to the 911 system. I mean, what this is a trophy. Somebody, in the course of getting this and disseminating it, was basically bragging about his ability to get into a certain computer, and that's all it is.
I'd like to...
And it's the coonskin on the wall.
That's exactly it. I'd like to read something from the current copy of 2600. We did kind of a review of the 911 document, and it's documentation on the emergency 911 system published in March of 1988. It retails for $79,449, and it's 6 pages long. This is basically what was found on that document, because it is widely disseminated. It otherwise would have been a quickly forgotten text published in a hacker newsletter, but due to all the commotion, the Bell South E911 document is now very much in the public eye. Copies are extremely easy to come by, despite Bell South's assertion that the whole thing is worth $79,449. All right, we're going to report on its contents, but don't get excited, there really isn't all that much here. Certain acronyms are introduced, among them Public Safety Answering Point, PSAP, also known as Emergency Service Bureau, ESB. This is what you get in telco lingo when you dial 911. The importance of close coordination between these agencies is stressed. Selective routing allows the 911 call to be routed to the proper PSAP. The 1A ESS is used as the tandem office for this routing. Certain services made available with E911 include forced disconnect, alternative routing, selective transfer, default routing, night service, automatic number identification, and automatic location identification. We learn of the existence of the E911 implementation team, the brave men and women from network marketing who help with configuration in the difficult cutover period. This team is in charge of forming an ongoing maintenance subcommittee. We wouldn't want that to get out now, would we? We learn that the Switching Control Center, known as the SCC, quote, is responsible for E911/1A ESS translations in tandem central offices, unquote. And I don't know about you, but I'm not exactly shocked by that revelation. We also find out what is considered a Priority 1 trouble report. Any link down to the PSAP fits this definition. We also learn that when ANI fails, the screens will display all zeros. Okay, we could go on, but we really don't want to bore you. None of this information would allow a hacker to gain access to such a system. All it affords is a chance to understand the administrative functions a little better. We'd like to assume that any outside interference to a 911 system is impossible. Does Bell South know otherwise? In light of their touchiness on the matter, we have to wonder. And I hear a clock going off somewhere. I guess it's striking 12 o'clock where you are.
Striking midnight in Wyoming.
Okay. Well, that's the scoop on the 911 documentation.
Review, I think that about sums it up.
For that particular document, we have several people facing over 30 years in jail for possessing it. I think that's sick in this day and age to frighten kids like that, you know?
Well, but, you know, you got a situation where the enforcers don't begin to understand the threats that they're trying to guard society against. The FBI agents that came to visit me had only the dimmest understanding of how a computer worked, what a computer could do. I showed him how to download a file, and he was completely blown away. Naturally, there's going to be a high level of superstition and misunderstanding on the part of these people. I mean, if somebody higher up says, go get them, they're doing something wrong, and the people that are actually supposed to enforce the laws are as technically unsophisticated as they are, you're bound to get all kinds of mix-ups.
It's kind of like government regulating art, because I would say art and computers are two things the government knows nothing about.
Right.
And two things that I feel very scared seeing them in control of. You know?
Well, except for the fact that I think if they're so technically incompetent that we're going to be able to run circles around them indefinitely. in the future, swiftness and maneuverability is going to be everything. And any agency that requires 150 agents for 2 years in order to confiscate some teenagers' equipment is not a very swift moving or even a very dangerous outfit. And I keep thinking of a line that somebody once used in reference to the administration of Frederick the Great, which was that it was despotism tempered by incompetence. And I think we have some of the same protections. But unfortunately, that incompetence can work both ways. And, you know, even as it is unable to find out who the real criminals are, it's so incompetent that it identifies all kinds of false criminals.
Let's talk about the FRAC newsletter being shut down. What are your perceptions on that?
Well, it seems as clear a violation of the First Amendment as practically anything I've ever run across. I mean, the only difference between FRAC and 2600 is that they use electronic media and they don't use print. But, you know, there is a precedent for this kind of institutionalized control over a medium in violation of the First Amendment that has stuck. And I give you the example of radio and broadcasting in general. There is government censorship and control over broadcasting, which isn't applied to print, and has at this stage been more or less institutionalized by precedent.
And
really what happened was at the very beginning, the government decided that they were going to maintain control over this new medium, and they managed to keep it. Now, we're right at the same pivotal point with the dissemination of electronic information, which is how, obviously, most information is now going to be disseminated. And the government is trying to establish the same kind of early on control over the medium.
But I think the difference here is that this kind of control over the medium could very easily grow to encompass the printed media as well.
Well, even if it doesn't, it's kind of irrelevant because print, you know, hard copy, is increasingly just the end product of electronic transmission. I mean, you don't have people out there sitting in front of linotypes or Underwood typewriters. I mean, information is taking the form of ones and zeros and wires before it ever reaches paper, and you can decide that you're going to establish control at any point and have a devastating effect on printed matter in the long run. I mean, here, this 911 document is a case in point. I suppose that you would have some constitutional protections for, and they would be exercised for printing this document in 2600. There's no difference between this document in 2600 and this document in electronic form, except for execution.
I can tell you, though, that I would never print, I would never allow this to be printed in anything I was working for because it's so boring, so
but
useless.
It's horrible.
It really is.
This really is one of the least dangerous. The only dangerous thing about this is that it might put you to sleep.
That's true. If you're driving it, don't read this while you're driving it. Don't read anything while you're driving, for that matter. But, in fact, I might have put some people to sleep when I was reading parts of it before, because
You could go into a deep coma reading this thing aloud.
You sure could. One wonders what happened to the person that wrote it. But enough of that. What's going to happen? What are the next steps? What should people be doing?
Well, I figure that whenever you've got an agency of the government that's out of control, the best thing you can do is invoke another part of the government against it. And in this case, fortunately, you've got the judiciary. The executive branch is running amok as usual. And I still have some limited faith in the ability of the courts, especially on the higher end, to enforce the Constitution. So what I've been spending my time doing for the last couple of days is lining up some serious, major, nasty lawyers to get involved on behalf of some of these kids.
What's been the response from the lawyers that you've talked to?
When I finally got to the right lawyers, it was very positive. And one of the, I can't name these folks now, but one of the most prestigious litigating law firms in New York just agreed to help out the three defendants that are in the New York area. I mean, I guess you can't call them defendants since they haven't been charged with anything.
Mm-hmm.
But these kids had their equipment taken from them almost 2 months ago, and have been under a constant rain of threats and veiled offers to mitigate charges if they would cooperate. And I don't think they should cooperate at all. I think if anything, they should come back fighting hard. And fortunately, I think they're about to have the means at hand.
Well, it's good to hear that somebody cares enough to do that. It also must be so frightening to not know what's going to happen next. You're not charged with anything. You play with something on your computer. You don't know what kind of crazy laws they're going to make up and misinterpret to send you away for God knows how long. It must be a really frightening experience to go through.
Well, in one of these cases, the Secret Service came in with, you know, 8 or 10 agents with guns drawn, and the only person home was the 12-year-old sister of one of these kids.
Well, I hope they were able to subdue her before she did anything.
Well, I guess they had her good and subdued by the time he got home, you know, half an hour later. They told this kid's mother that, as far as they were concerned, he was responsible for the AT&T systems crash in February and probably cost the nation $1 billion. That's how they put it to her. I mean, you can imagine what she thought.
It's incredible because, first of all, AT&T has admitted that it was their fault that that happened. So, do you have any sense that perhaps these people really don't understand the first thing about any of this? They don't know what these kids are being charged with themselves?
I'm completely certain of it. I mean, you know, one great story, one of these kids was telling me that he was riding up in the elevator, and they'd taken all manner of stuff, like his music tapes and his tape player and his telephone answering machine, and one of these agents is riding up in the elevator next to him with the answering machine in his hand, and he looks at the answering machine, he looks at the kid, and he says, "All right, what is this?" And the kid said, "Well, it's an answering machine." And the agent next to the guy that's holding the answering machine says, "What'd he say?" So there you are. I mean, you know, these people don't even know what an answering machine is. We're not talking about any kind of technical sophistication here, and these are matters where, in order to understand what's going on, a certain level of technical sophistication is absolutely mandatory.
And I think if that level of technical sophistication were achieved by the people that sign the warrants and the people that execute the warrants, maybe they'd see that these warrants are kind of crazy in the first place, that they're not accomplishing anything. And I think that's a very important step that we've got to reach pretty quickly, because a lot of innocent kids are being victimized here. People who really should be the leaders of the next generation, I suppose, the people that are curious, intelligent, and the people who ask a lot of questions. Right now, that's something that can get you in jail.
Asking questions could always get you in jail.
I guess.
You know, I mean, for a significant portion of human history, asking questions could get you burned at the stake, hung, drawn, and quartered, tortured to death. I mean, you name it. Asking questions has never been popular with control freaks.
Now, who do you define as control freaks? Anybody in charge?
Oh, no. I mean, I have enough faith in some forms of government to assume that there are plenty of people that have the same attitude towards the controllability of life that I do. But I guess the way I would... A control freak is somebody who is terrified by uncertainty. Somebody who believes that ambiguity is something that can be defined out of any situation. and that the only way to do that is by establishing legal or other forms of control over human behavior. And that's a control freak. And there are lots of them. They take many different forms.
Well, I'd like to get into this a little further. We'll talk about the Robert Morris sentencing perhaps as well, but mostly talk about what lies ahead for these people that have been charged. We were talking to Steve Jackson a little bit earlier. His publishing company in Austin, Texas, was raided by the Secret Service because they did not like a particular game that he was producing that had to do with science fiction, cyberpunks, and that kind of thing. They thought it was a handbook on how to commit computer crime. And we were talking to him earlier. He said he estimated that he's lost about $125,000 as a result, and he's almost been driven out of business. One thing that that I can't figure out, and maybe John Barlow, you can help us here. He said the American Civil Liberties Union did not take an interest in this. Why do you suppose that was?
I wish I could figure that out. I finally got on the phone yesterday with somebody from the ACLU, who is the only person there that I know of that's knowledgeable about these matters. And he said that he hadn't even heard of it, and asked me to tell Steve Jackson and whoever else that had contacted the, or tried to contact the ACLU without success, to get a hold of him. So I think maybe things are turning around there. My guess is that when the initial contacts were made, either by Jackson or some of the other folks that made an effort to get help from the ACLU, they just talked to people who were not knowledgeable about these matters and had the same kind of social dread of computer crackers that you know, most people who read the newspapers have come to acquire.
I think you know, with the case of the ACLU, there is a degree of ignorance there, too.
Oh, sure.
They don't understand the technology. They don't see the implications. An electronic newsletter in St. Louis gets shut down. Is that not the same thing as a newspaper in New York City getting shut down? You know, it's you have to understand the technology a bit to see the similarities and to understand what's really happening. And I think it's up to people like you and me and our listeners to educate those that can certainly help out in a situation like this, to educate the ACLU, to educate the elected officials and the media and our friends and relatives and everybody else. Because, you know, when people come up to you and say that they really think Robert Morris should have been put away for 10 years, you have to wonder, what do they really think that he did? You know, he made a mistake. He was playing with a computer program and it got out of hand. And for that, you're supposed to go to jail?
What he did was a religious crime, really.
How so?
Well, in the sense that in this, the religion of this culture is rationality and science. And a lot of people don't understand science. In fact, most of the people who have the most devout form of scientific religion don't understand the most basic tenet of science, which is that everything is up for grabs. And we don't really know anything. We just have a vast stack of theories. But these people imbue computers with a kind of holy mystic quality. And what Robert Morris was doing was messing around in the temple. He was defiling the sacred by some mysterious means that most of the folks that are incensed about this couldn't begin to imagine.
It's interesting. The judge, after sentencing him, I'm told, said, I still want to find out more about how this works.
Really?
He never really quite understood it, but thankfully the judge was intelligent enough to realize that there was no malice here. There was no bad intent on Robert Morris's part, and he went against the guidelines for conviction in a particular crime like that, which pretty much say that you have to send somebody to jail who's convicted of this. He said, obviously, this person was doing something out of curiosity, not out of, you know, out of maliciousness. And he sentenced him to a fine, probation, that kind of thing, which is probably appropriate. Prison. What do you get out of prison? You know, what's the point? And fortunately, he was able to see that. I'm just afraid for all these other people that are now undergoing this. will they get someone as intelligent when their judgment day comes?
Well, you know, that's this is the kind of thing that gives me a little faith in the judiciary as a balance against the executive branch. I mean, for one thing, if you sit long enough in a courtroom and listen to enough evidence, no matter how ignorant you are when you start out, you'll know something about it when you're done. And I'm fairly well persuaded that the judges of this country are going to know more about computer crime than anybody who's in enforcement in fairly short order.
Well, that's true, but if they only hear it from the prosecution and they don't hear it from the defendants themselves, because they're really the only people that understand what it was that they did and what it is that's going on, if they don't hear that, then... What they come up with is going to be very imbalanced.
Yeah. I hate to admit my ignorance, but I wasn't aware that there had been a sentence handed down in the Morris case. When did that happen?
That happened about 2 weeks ago.
Really?
Yeah, the beginning of May.
I've been traveling around too fast, I guess. Do you know what the sentence was?
Yes, in fact, fortunately, and this will serve as a terrific lead-in for the pitch I'm going to have to do in a second, there's an update on that in the current edition of 2600 Magazine. Let me just turn to the right page here. And we have Robert Morris sentenced on May 4th. His runaway worm created havoc on the Internet over the fall of 1988, and he was sentenced to 3 years probation, a $10,000 fine, and 400 hours of community service. Now, he could have received up to 5 years in prison along with a $250,000 fine. So that's the update from Robert Morris. And considering what that sentence could have been, I think it was fair. If you're going to say that he committed a crime at all, I think that was something that is acceptable. Now, we are in the middle of our fundraising drive here at WBAI, and we want to be able to continue to bring you programs like this where we discuss controversial issues that aren't discussed anywhere else, and I challenge you to find a program, a newspaper, a magazine that approaches computer hacking from the hacker's point of view. You won't find it anywhere else, unless it's another Pacifica station in another part of the country, probably, but no place else. That's why we need to hear from you now. We're in the middle of our... Actually, we're not in the middle. We're right at the end of our fundraiser, and we need to pull in a few more calls. The number is 212-279-3400. If you've gotten something out of this program, if you've learned something that you didn't know before, if what you've heard outrages you and makes you think, makes you want to get more involved, make an investment. Make an investment in all the things that you can hear in the future, because it's an ongoing thing, not just with computers, not just with technology, but all the different things WBAI covers in its 24-hour broadcast day. By calling 279-3400, you can become a part of WBAI. You can become a part of the process of thinking and expressing yourself. And for a pledge of $55, you'll get a year of 2600 Magazine, the Hacker Quarterly, the magazine that brings you information like this, brings you the facts as they unfold, and brings them to you in a way nobody else does. It's important that we see those phones start to light up so that we know there's people out there that are willing to make a donation to the radio station and keep it going so more people can hear this, so that these thoughts won't be stifled. Think to yourself, if WBAI were not here, how would we ever find out about this? You know, you'd have to know where to look. You'd have to know who to speak to, and you'd have to track them down. But we make it easy for you. All you have to do is turn on your radio at any time of the day or night, and I guarantee you, you'll be hearing things that you can't hear elsewhere. May not always be things you want to hear, you know? Sometimes you'll turn on the radio and you'll have to run screaming out of the room or something. It happens. It happens to everybody. It happened to me the other day, but I won't say what show it was. The fact of the matter is, WBAI serves a very important role in the community. And we need your help to fulfill that role. 279-3400, area code 212, help us out. Because by helping us out, you'll be benefiting in the long run. In fact, in the short run, you'll be benefiting because You'll be getting the WBAI program guide for a year, and also you'll be getting 2600 magazine for the next year. And that will update you as to all the scary things that are going on with high tech. And there's a lot of scary things, as I'm sure, John, you're well familiar with. There's many things going on out there that the average person just doesn't know about.
By the way, Eric, that was such a great pitch that I don't want to have to hang up and dial your other number, but you could sign me up.
Okay, well, we'll have to figure out a way to transfer you to the pledge line, but...
You can just give my address. You've got it.
Well, maybe you can hit upon a point I haven't already hit upon, because after you're on for a long time and you keep saying the same thing, I don't know, maybe you lose the conviction in your voice or something, but I don't know, does it make sense to you? Should people reach out and support a station like this?
Sure. I mean, that's kind of... If you don't have truly free organs of information that don't owe anything to advertisers and don't owe anything to the government and don't care who they irritate, you're not free anymore. It's as simple as that. I mean, obviously, I've listened to some amazing stuff on Pacifica stations. I mean, talk about running screaming from the room. I was listening to the Pacifica outlet in Berkeley not too long ago, and they had an interview with not one, but two or three gay Ethiopian female poets. And it was just, it was the kind of thing that only a Pacifica station would do, and it was absurd. But, on the other hand, I can't imagine any other station that would give any kind of in-depth reporting of computer hacking, as you say, from the computer hacker's point of view. And that's right now, that's a critical piece of information.
It sure is. First of all, there's a reason why other media outlets won't do that. It's because sponsors would see it as too controversial, as too threatening to the products that they sell. Hearing what computer hackers have to say, that's kind of risky there.
Absolutely.
But it's necessary. In this day and age, what computer hackers are learning and figuring out and revealing is something that's going to be affecting us for decades, centuries to come. We could be seeing things that, if left unchecked, could result in a lot of our civil rights being violated flagrantly in the decades to come. We have to look upon this now, because the world is moving into the electronic age with breathtaking speed, and we've got to know what is right and what is wrong. If you just leave it up to somebody else and say, oh, we trust them, you're making a very big mistake, a mistake that's been made many, many times before in the past, but a mistake that we can do something about now. I'm not saying that by calling 279-3400 and pledging to WBAI, you're going to be solving the world's problems, but you'll be making things better for yourself, because you'll be opening up your eyes. You'll be becoming a part of the process, and you'll be helping ensure that voices like the ones you're hearing tonight will continue to come your way. If that means something to you, please make that call. You are the person that can make the difference. We have people at 2:30 in the morning sitting in a room in Midtown Manhattan waiting to take your call. They're down there. They've sacrificed their whole evening to be here to take your call. So please make that time worthwhile. And it'll be worth your while, too, because you'll be getting a year's worth of 2600 magazine. By the way, you don't have to get 2600 magazine if you don't want to. There's all kinds of other levels you can pledge at. The important thing is that you call now and pledge whatever it is you can afford to the radio station to help keep us going, because we want to be around next year. We want to be around in the year 2000. We want to be around for a good long time. And we don't want to sell commercials, because once we do that, you can forget about programs like this. But the day may come when we have to do that, and that might sound like a threat, but it's not. It's something that is always threatening us. It's a threat to us. We're just telling the reality as it is. 279-3400. Let's get two phone calls, and we can go back to our discussion and take some phone calls, because I'd really like to cover the rest of this story. There's still more to go on the story, and we've been talking about this since. Since 11:45 this evening, yesterday evening, actually. This There's so much going on. There's so much going on, it's just one story. Imagine all the stories that we can cover in the weeks, months, years ahead. 279-3400, make that call now, area code 212.
You know, Eric, one of the things that I was thinking about while I was listening to you talk there is that one of the problems you've got with market-driven media is that there's this sort of channel scan consciousness that now applies to radio as well as television. And information is now being presented in smaller and smaller bits. A good case in point was the interview that you and I did for CBS a month and a half ago. Here we were talking about the same kinds of issues, and we had 6 minutes to cover this whole range of stuff. Well, that was absurd, you know. I mean, especially starting out with a guy who was concerned that we might break into his home computer even though it wasn't connected to a telephone line. You know, we were dealing with an interviewer that had that level of technical sophistication.
Yeah, I find that whenever I'm interviewed by somebody that's talking about computer hackers, they always start off by saying, "I don't know anything about computers." And I keep asking myself, well, then why in hell are you doing this story if you don't know anything about the subject?
Right. What qualifies them to even discuss it in a public setting?
Yet people look to them as the providers of the information, the people that that they trust and believe. But if they don't know what they're talking about, how can you trust and believe them?
Right.
It's so absurd. It's funny. But it's not funny because people are getting hurt by this. So, let's give out that phone number one more time. I really want to see some more lines light up because we do need help here, folks. We do need help, and you're the people that can help us. You're the person that can help us, you listening right now. I see all the call-in lines are lit up. Great. You know, we want to hear what you have to say, but we also need that real financial support. We take Visa. We take MasterCard. Right now, we want to take your phone calls. 212-279-3400. There's a phone call. Great. Let's get one more in there, and we can go and take some more phone calls and talk about the other issues that are affecting us. Because these are, I can talk about this till 6 in the morning. I'm not going to. We're only on for another hour. But it's so incredible, the things that are happening. It could be so wonderful and marvelous to see technology developing, blossoming, to see people getting control over technology, being able to produce their own music, produce their own magazines. It can be so incredible, so great, so inspiring, but it can also be detrimental if we don't have the control that we deserve. You know, it's technology is, it can be our salvation, it can be our damnation. Hey, that's a sound bite, isn't it?
Yeah, that is your work for the CBS interview, Eric.
I should have said that.
It doesn't say anything.
No, it doesn't say much, but I should have said it on CBS. No, they love sound bites when you say one sentence. You know, they'll use one sentence.
Right.
Of everything you said, they'll use one sentence, and that they'll get wrong somehow. You know,
right.
I don't want to come down too hard on media people because I do think they mean well, but they're not guided properly. They have to understand what it is they're talking about and whose responsibility is that, if not ours, the people that understand what's going on. We've got to take that control. And you, our listeners, have got to take that control too, because by supporting WBAI, you are making a statement. You're saying this matters, and your contribution makes us stronger. It allows us to speak more frequently and more consistently, and that's what matters. That's what matters in this day and age. You have to be heard. Not necessarily the loudest, shrillest voice, but a voice loud enough to be heard over the deafening roar of sensationalism which is ever present. Boy, you know, as the night progresses, I'm coming up with these weird phrases, so please excuse me. The number is 279-3400. I see we're getting calls. That's very good to know because I like to know that people are out there and they care. They care enough to support the station. Remember, a $55 pledge will get you a year of 2600 magazine. I guarantee you this magazine will open your eyes. It really will. It's something that, you know, if we could afford to send it to everybody in the country, we would, because people deserve to see this. And right now, 2600 is donating an unlimited number of copies, well, until we go bankrupt anyway, to WBAI as part of this fundraiser. So however many people call up and pledge $55 to WBAI, all that money goes to WBAI. None of it goes back to 2600, and we'll donate the subscriptions for a good cause, for freedom of speech and for free airwaves and that kind of thing. 279-3400, area code 212. Make that call now, because tomorrow may be too late. Next week will definitely be too late. Our fundraiser ends on Saturday. And in an hour, you won't be able to get 2600 anymore through this radio station. So please give a call now and make that pledge. Remember, we take Visa and we take MasterCard, so it doesn't have to be a cash outlay for you right away. It can take time. It can take a few months, or however long you spread out your Visa or MasterCard bills. You know, the country is founded on credit. I suppose the individual people should use some credit themselves too. 212-279-3400. I want to take a very quick musical break so I can get something to drink, and then we're going to take some phone calls and talk some more about what's going on in the computer hacker world and with the Secret Service raids and all that kind of thing. We're speaking to John Perry Barlow out in Wyoming. What city in Wyoming are you in?
Pinedale.
And what is it, out in Twin Peaks country somewhere?
Yeah, just like that.
Okay, we'll talk more about that in a little while. We're going to come back right after this musical break, and we'll be taking your phone calls. The number to call if you want to speak to John Perry Barlow and myself, Emmanuel Goldstein, is 279-3407. If you get a busy signal, just keep trying, because eventually you might get through. Let's put it that way. There's a lot of people calling in right now. 279-3407 to be on the air. But more importantly, it really is more important at this point that we get financial support as well, because that is what allows us to continue to bring you programs like this and to continue to take your calls in the future. So call 279-3400 to make a pledge. And if you're trying to reach 3407 and you find it's busy, give a call to 279-3400. Make a pledge and then try 3407 again. You know, a lot of people say, hey, I called 279-3407, it was busy, so I called and I made a pledge, and you know what? After I made the pledge, I hung up and I called 279-3407, and it wasn't busy. I'm not saying that's going to happen necessarily, but it could. Nice things happen to people that... And that sounds like a chain letter, so I'm going to stop right here. 279-3400, please make that call, make a pledge, 212 area code. And if you want to get through and speak to John Perry Barlow and myself on this special edition of The Fifth Corner, 212-279-3407. And by the way, thanks to all those of you who have been calling in. We really do appreciate it. We appreciate it a lot. We're now going to take a quick musical break. We'll be right back.